Andrew Greeley is a Roman Catholic priest, a sociologist, and the author of many books. Most of his books are about sociology, politics, or theology. Four of them are best-selling novels. They are Cardinal Sins, Thy Neighbor's Wife, Ascent into Hell, and Lord of the Dance. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Tucson in Arizona and a senior research associate at the National Opinion Research Center in Chicago. Mary Greeley Durkin was a suburban housewife with six children when she decided to go back to school and study theology. She's taught at DePaul College and Loyola University, and she's the author of two books, Marital Intimacy, A Catholic Perspective, and Feast of Love, an analysis of Pope John Paul II's Lectures on Sexuality. In How to Save the Catholic Church, Andrew Greeley and Mary Greeley Durkin say that the American Catholic Church often overemphasizes doctrine and hierarchy at the expense of the sensibility and identity of rank-and-file Catholics. They believe that Catholics can save their church from a disaffected membership and an aloof leadership only by re-examining Catholic traditions, rituals, and ideals. How to Save the Catholic Church is published by the Viking Press. I want to welcome you both to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Well, your book is titled How to Save the Catholic Church, so let's start with what indications you have that the church needs saving in the first place.
Well, you probably don't go back this far, but we do, back to the 30s and 40s and 50s, when the Catholic Church for us in America was primarily a church of rules and regulations. It seemed that you were a Catholic if you followed rules. And if you didn't follow those rules, then you were out of the church. Then along came the Second Vatican Council, and there was a big upheaval. And now there don't seem to be as many rules, or at least people aren't obeying the rules. And there is a great deal of confusion about what it means to be a Catholic. If being a Catholic meant following rules, what are we going to do now that we don't have rules to follow or that people aren't following them? How do we become or how do we act as Catholics when we don't have rules? And so we are offering in this book a formula, not so much a formula, but some suggestions about what the church is really about. Catholicism is not about rules, but it's about religion and the experience of religion. It's about how our imaginations are affected, how we are inspired to live life to the fullest by what it is that we believe.
The best thing about Catholicism, from our point of view, are stories. Stories of Christmas, of angels, of saints, Easter, all those wonderful festivals that always appeal to Catholics. And our position is that if your imagination is Catholic for the first 7 years of your life, give Catholicism a shot at your imagination for those 7 years. Then the pictures and the images and the stories and the experiences will be with you for the rest of your days. And you will always find that part of Catholicism attractive and indeed compelling, no matter what stupid things or insensitive things your leadership may do. The real question in the book is not how to save the church as so much as what is uniquely and specifically Catholic, as my sister said. And we say it's the images and the pictures and the stories.
And this will really be transmitted to people, understood better by people, when we appreciate the importance of the family as church for people.
I get the impression that you think when Vatican II took away some of the rules, that there was also some of the important ritual and ceremony that was taken away as well.
Well, I think a fair number of us, and by us I particularly mean priests, thought that the Vatican Council was a signal that we were to abandon a lot of the things that our Protestant brothers and sisters thought were superstitious, and that we had begun to look as kind of on a silly piety, souls in purgatory and angels and saints and even the Blessed Mother. Now, I think a lot of those devotions and rituals and stories in Catholicism needed to be reinterpreted. They needed to be updated, but they shouldn't have been thrown out. We threw out the baby with the bathwater and the baby's mother, too. And the baby's mother, of course, turns out to be one of the great overarching symbols of Western culture. You can't throw it out, and you shouldn't.
What are some of the symbols or rituals that you think have been taken away post-Vatican II that you would have liked to have seen reinterpreted?
Well, I think that we, as my brother was mentioning, Mary was a very, very important symbol. But there were many things connected with Mary, rosaries and novenas, and they became somewhat superstitious. But I think if we were to reinterpret those things, if we were to reconsider the whole idea of liturgy as it was it gave people an opportunity to communicate with God that we don't really have in present-day liturgy. Present-day liturgy is sort of a fixed ritual that we are told this is how you communicate with God, and you don't have an awful lot of freedom. You don't have the devotions that we had in the past, so that when you had someone in your family who was very ill, if you wanted to pray to a certain saint, and somehow you felt that you were communicating with God on this particular crisis in your family at that point in time, you don't have those kinds of opportunities today. So I think that's one area that we could begin to look at.
And there's two things that always fascinate me, the angels and the souls in purgatory. I've been reading a lot of science fiction lately because someone wants me to write science fiction stories. And the science fiction stories are filled with angels and with demons. I'm reading a book now called Prince Umbra, and it's about the devil and about an angel fighting the devil. Well, these are wonderful stories about the struggle between good and evil that goes on in the world and every one of our personalities. And this conflict between angels and demons is a story about that conflict between good and evil. And we lost some marvelous stories when we put aside angels and devils. Now, are there real angels or real devils? Well, there are powers of evil in this cosmos that go beyond our comprehension. Hitler and Stalin, the head of the two most powerful nations in Europe. I mean, that's something diabolic. Whether there are personal demons or not, I don't know. But I do know there's evil in the world. And whether there are personal angels, angels represent God's personal love for us. I would like to think they're just such distinct beings. But more important than whether there are really distinct beings like angels, the characters in Steven Spielberg's Spaceships. At least the story of angels represents God's personal love for us, and it's a story worth telling. The souls in purgatory, what are you going to tell a kid in the dentist chair? I mean, in the old days, kid was in the dentist chair, you say, well, offer it up for the souls in purgatory. I got so many souls out of purgatory when I was wearing braces, and now I feel kind of cheated. What purgatory stands for, of course, is vicarious suffering. We can offer our suffering for others. That's a very sound human instinct. If you're not going to teach it through the souls in purgatory, then you better find some other way of teaching it. We give up purgatory, and D.M. Thomas, in the wonderful coda of his novel, The White Hotel, has this brilliant vision of a purgatory as a place where we straighten out the messed up relationships of our life. It's a story, it's an image, it's a picture which tells something very important about the nature of reality. I don't think we should have given up. Bring it back, reinterpret it, rehabilitate it, and realize it's an important part of our heritage.
Do you think that the church has become too literal, where, like, if you can't offer proof for something like angels and demons, that you've got to abandon it because, you know, it doesn't really exist and you can't rely on it as a metaphor?
We threw St. Christopher out of the calendar because he may never have existed. And so
we tried to throw St. Patrick out of the calendar.
Well, he did throw St. Patrick out of the universe.
Not the
calendar.
Irish didn't, though.
St. Nicholas, the wonderful patron of little children, we got rid of him. St. Catherine of Alexandria, the most popular woman saint in history outside those in the Bible, she got thrown out because she probably never existed. But yeah, at one level, we have to be scientific, we have to be precise and say these people probably didn't exist. And the other level, a deeper level, we have to say, but their stories tell us something about the meaning of life and the nature of God's love for us, and that is too important to pass up.
I was thinking, too, this month being All Souls Month and starting out with the Feast of All Saints, that those were things that are very, very important. I just came back from Ireland, and someone over there was saying, we never threw those out, that this is a way in Ireland that we communicate with those who have gone before us, and it's a very hopeful sign. And we used to have a lot of rituals here, and special prayers on three masses on All Saints or All Souls Day for the souls in purgatory. And I don't think people do that as much anymore. And yet it's a way of feeling that you are in touch with those who have gone before.
Once you begin to look at these things through the point of view of comparative religions, and I'm a sociologist of religion, you realize that there are deep and profound human truths, which we share with a lot of other of the world's religions, that were far too easily dismissed. Now, November is the month of the year when nature dies. The splendid red and gold vanishes from the trees, and the parks look stark and naked, and we know it's going to get colder in winter, and we begin to think about death. And November is the month of the holy souls. It's a month of hope. It's a month in which, in the old days, we Catholics used to realize that life is stronger than death and hope is stronger than despair. Now, maybe we don't bring back the souls in purgatory, or maybe we do. The point here is that we need stories and images and symbols and rituals which celebrate hope in the face of death.
But those symbols and rituals need to be reevaluated and maybe...
I think
sometimes
there was superstition, And mm-hmm. I think this is one of the reasons why, especially among the more educated laity, a lot of things got thrown out because we didn't want to be accused of being superstitious. And it probably has some links to our immigrant background. We wanted to be considered sophisticated. And if we, you know, had our rosary beads and if we went to novenas and we believed there was some power in that, it was looked upon as magic. And we wanted to be more rational. You mentioned the term rational and literal and more sophisticated. So I do think that if we bring these things back, as Andy said, we have to reinterpret them and not have them be at that superstitious level. But as we say in the book, that's a problem with the Catholic approach to understanding life, is that we allow or we believe that God is present in everything, and so sometimes we do tend to border over into the superstitious. But
the Mary symbol, for example, I mean, at one time, when we were growing up, Mary was a negative sex goddess. Huh? I mean, in Mary's name, the morality of prom dresses was judged by measuring tape. You know, how much calf and how much cleavage was to be was shown, and all in the name of the Mother of Jesus. In fact, of course, what Mary represents is the womanliness of God. In the Catholic heritage, that's always been Mary's function. Sometimes we haven't been all that clear about it, that God is a mother as well as a father. The Protestants used to say, well, you Catholics worship Mary. And we said, no, we don't. Actually, we did, or at least we did in a way. Through Mary, we worship the motherhood of God, the womanliness of God. God is mother as well as father. God is a she as well as a he. And in this day and age, when we have to come to terms with the total equality of women, Mary is an enormously important resource for the Church, and it's a shame to mess to forget her historic importance and her present implications.
How do you, in feminist terms, explain the virginity of Mary?
Well, again, I'm not going to deny the virginity of Mary, but I think we have to understand that the celebration of the virginity of Mary is very, very much tied into a belief in the divinity of Jesus. Jesus is a special child. His mother is a special woman. If we want to focus on Mary only as a symbol of a virgin, we still can't deny that she was a sexual human being. She has a female body. She was a mother. She nursed her child. And she was a sexual person in every cell of her body. So that I don't think the fact of her virginity is a negative sign for feminists. I mean, I think the fact that at some times in human history when she was worshipped or put on a pedestal because she was a virgin, that some of the people that said, well, she was only good because she wasn't sexual, that was a wrong interpretation of the symbol. But I think she's a great symbol for feminists, really.
Remember the old proms when they used to sing Mother Beloved at the end so that the boys and girls wouldn't go out and neck and pet afterwards?
Oh, well, that was before my day.
Incidentally, one thing I should mention, why my sister did have 6 children when she went to graduate school. She had a 7th while she was in graduate school. We mustn't leave that 7th child.
Okay. She would be very offended if she were loaded.
My guests, if you're just joining us, are Andrew Greeley and Mary Greeley Durkin. They're brother and sister, and they've co-authored a book together called How to Save the Catholic Church. Well, let's discuss the question of women's equality. Obviously, you both believe in the equality of women and would like to see the Church endorse that. In, I think, every aspect of organized religion in America, or in most of the organized religions, there are women working within each religion to try to reform it in a way that recognizes women's equality. Do you think that the Catholic Church has been any more behind or advanced in dealing
Certainly
with the equality of women?
In its dealings with women, I don't think you could say that. The Church has a great problem with women that is tied into what we claim in the book, and I think we believe, is that there is a great deal of fear and mistrust and hatred of women that has caused the Catholic Church to really ignore its belief in sacramentality when it thinks about women. Women's bodies are evil.
Trap of Satan to ensnare men, that's what they are.
Because of the effect that they can have on men. This has unfortunately been the dominant view of women among many church leaders in the past, and I think there are remnants of it even today. So there is this fear and hatred and mistrust of women, which is totally contrary to what the church believes when it says that human life is sacramental. And when we go back and we look at the scriptures, and the Pope in some audience addresses that he gave on the theology of the body and sexuality makes a claim that God comes into the world through human beings that are made in the divine image, male and female, that we only appreciate God when we appreciate both masculinity and femininity, and that we will never really begin to understand God until we appreciate the femininity of God. So then we have to appreciate the feminine experience. So I would argue that until we are able to have women contributing to discussions of religion, that we're never really going to have a religion that's whole.
It's not just the church, though, Terry. You know, on this tour my sister and I are doing for our book, there's a number of television programs that want me but not her, which, needless to say, I don't go on. But, I mean, it's the same thing we do in the church. They want the man, they don't want the woman, and I find that profoundly offensive. Also, while I would not attempt to defend the horrendous chauvinism of the clergy and the hierarchy, Catholicism is a very complicated institution, and I think we have to say that women probably have more check-signing power in the church than they do in most other human institutions. I mean, heads of hospitals and schools and colleges. So historically, the situation of women in the church has been complex and ambiguous. On the one hand, probably more power and influence than in most human institutions, but on the other hand, still treated like second-class citizens.
You've referred to women's bodies as being distrusted by the church hierarchy. Do you think that ties in any way to the current policy on birth control within the Catholic Church?
I think that the church will not be able to have a positive theology of sexuality, and it's only until they appreciate women, and I think it's their lack of a positive theology of sexuality that leads to their negative statements on family planning, birth control, and things like that. And I think that it is this misunderstanding of women. I think, first of all, we have to say that in the human condition, it is understandable that men would be afraid of women. If we go back to primitive societies, women bled. You know, they bled once a month more than if a man bled like that in battle, he would die. There was a mystery about women that men could not understand. And when men were more powerful than women, then they really sought to banish them from things that were worthwhile. So I think that it's understandable why in the human situation there would be a certain fear of this person who was so powerfully attractive and yet also a threat, and that what has happened in most of human history, the church has really just reflected the way the society has felt about women. And what I would like to see the church do today is be a leader in helping the world come to appreciate the godliness of woman or womanliness.
You read
of God.
Umberto Eco's novel, The Name of the Rose, and one is struck by the terrible things those monks believed about women. You know, they were graveyards, they were cesspools, they were swamps. Well, unfortunately, that sort of attitude wasn't limited to the 14th century. I mean, we were trained in the seminary in attitudes not unlike that. And I think most of the church's sexual hang-ups really come from a fear of women, that on the one hand, celibates should stay away from women because women are a threat to their virtue, and married men should have as little as possible to do with them because women are a threat to their manliness. Women are a necessary evil, but don't enjoy them too much because then you'll get in trouble.
You give the statistic, I think this is right, that 9 out of 10 Catholics disagree with the Pope's position on birth control.
Out of 10 priests, too.
Really? Now, yet, this Pope is such a popular Pope in America. I mean, that's such a seeming paradox. How do you reconcile these things, that so many people disagree with a policy that really affects their marital life, the most personal aspect of their lives, yet the Pope is so popular?
Well, the Pope is popular in one way because he's a very charismatic man and he adds a certain amount of excitement to religion when he comes around. But I think the issue of birth control and people's reaction to it is an example of how people are beginning to be weaned away from the whole rules approach to religion. They realize that in certain areas they have to make decisions. And that although people might admire the Pope, I would imagine that 90% of the people who flocked to see him when he was here 5 years ago did not agree with his positions on birth control.
And didn't change their minds because of what he said. There's one woman in Ireland said to me, ah, sure, the Pope, he's such a wonderful man, but the poor dear doesn't know anything about marriage.
Well, you know, that's interesting. Do you think that a lot of people feel like, why should they accept the word of men who have never experienced sex about what their own sex life should be?
Well, it may be partly that, but I think, you know, an awful lot of the parish clergy who haven't experienced marriage either are on the side of the laity on this one. It's more that when the hierarchy of the church says that the husbands and wives practically shouldn't sleep with one another, the married people say, hey, you know, that doesn't make sense. They don't know what they're talking about. Most parish priests wouldn't say that. So I don't think it's just celibacy. It's a question of the power structure of the church and the conviction in Rome that if you change on this, the whole authority of the church is going to collapse. I think the truth of the matter is just the other way around, precisely because the authority wasn't flexible on the birth control issue. Its credibility was destroyed.
What would you like to see the church say or do in regard to sexuality, marital sex, premarital sex?
Well, I think that what the church has to do as far as sexuality is concerned is offer a positive inspiration about how to face the various crises of your life and the various complications of your life that you encounter because of the fact that half of the human race comes in male form and the other half in female form. This causes problems. It offers us great opportunities, and we should respond. The church should be challenging us to respond to those opportunities. And in fact, this present Pope, who comes down sounding very negatively when he speaks about birth control, has developed a very positive vision of human sexuality. And it seems to me if we could pick up on that and for a while not think about the ethical issues, but begin to inspire people to see that they have been given bodies with sexuality in order to reflect God. If they had that kind of an inspiration, sure, sometimes people are going to do things that aren't right as far as their sexual lives are concerned. But if they're, instead of saying, well, this is a sin and you are no longer a Catholic or you're breaking the rules of the Catholic Church, if they would begin to think, well, I haven't been able to live up to the vision, but I'm going to try a little harder and live my life, live my sexuality as a gift from God that will say to others, God is love, or love is the meaning of life.
Sex is a sacrament. That is to say, it is something that tells us what God is like. And the more aroused a passionate lover is, the more that lover reflects God. What is God like? Well, God is even more passionate, even more violent, even more hopelessly in love than a passionately aroused sexual lover in the presence of someone she or he deeply cares for. Husbands and wives, in a very real sense, represent God most effectively to one another at the height of their physical passion for one another. Now, if this be true, and it is true, it's been always part of the Christian tradition. St. Paul himself said marriage is the great sacrament. If this be true, then obviously the church has an awful lot to say to the sustaining and the growth of love between spouses. One of my friends once came into the office and tossed on my desk a document from Rome in which they warned about said the married laity should realize the dangers of unbridled passion. And this fellow says, don't they realize that the big problem in our marriage is that the passion is too bridled? We need more unbridled passion if we're going to keep our love alive. Well, I think that's what the church ought to be doing. In addition to whatever regulations it must give in the way of negative rules, it also should help married women and men to keep their passionate romance alive. And if we could do that, there wouldn't be any problem about credibility anymore, if we had something to contribute to that struggle.
And I think there's a big fear on the part of the hierarchy and actually on the part of many even liberal Catholics, that if something isn't done about marriage, that everyone is just going to run off and get a divorce. In other words, if the church loosens its stand on marriage or on divorce, that everyone is just going to go crazy. You know, and that divorce is such an attractive thing. And it's just a lack of understanding of what, you know, the fact that divorce isn't something that people want to do. Sometimes they have to do it, but it's not something that people are going to run out and get a divorce right away. And I think that it's kind of a fear of the laity's ability to deal with some of these crises in their lives that keeps the church being very negative.
It's the temptation of the Grand Inquisitor. You don't want those lay people to be too free, particularly with sex, because God knows what they'll do if they're free. And the answer is, of course, yes, God knows. And God, she made us that way. She made us pervasively passionate people, the only animal that we know of that's sexy all the time. And if God made us that way, as apparently we were made that way, so that we might be deeper and richer and more powerful lovers.
And I think if the church could convey a positive vision of marital intimacy and really say that this is what people should be striving for, that's the way to help people find happiness in marriage and not see divorce as an attractive alternative.
So what if, I'm sorry.
No, that's
we should give you a chance to talk.
No. But I was just wondering what effect you think it has on people who just really enjoy going to church and want to participate in it and like the feeling it gives them to participate in a communal spiritual experience, but they disagree with some of the decisions made by the hierarchy, and they know that they're violating those rules, so they're kind of like living two lives. They want to participate in the spirituality of the religious service, but when they're home, they know that they're disobeying what their spiritual leaders have told them.
Well, at the present time, at least the research evidence indicates there's a large, large percentage of Catholics. 90% of the church-going Catholics don't agree on the birth control issue. Now, that doesn't mean that all of them are practicing birth control, because some of them aren't in the age where they have to. Catholics, we call it selective Catholicism. Catholics are not as bothered. Now, there is perhaps a 10% of the Catholic population that is extremely bothered if they would be practicing birth control or disobeying some of the rules of the church. And it's a shame, because the very people who are setting up these rules and requiring them as the standard for being Catholic are not helping the people that are struggling with this. They're not helping them see how they can still live their lives and follow these rules. So you say to someone, well, you cannot practice birth control, and they're not really giving them the help to increase their marital love.
Well, let me just reintroduce you both. I'm speaking with Mary Durkin Greeley and Andrew Greeley, who have co-authored a new book together called How to Save the Catholic Church, and in it they propose many reforms, some of which we are discussing now. I don't think you really address the issue of abortion in the book, but I'd be interested to see what you had to say on it and what stand you think the church should be taking on it.
I think Governor Cuomo, in his talk at Notre Dame, summarized pretty well what my position is. I personally would find myself very much opposed to abortion, but I wouldn't think that in our pluralistic society it is something that I would want, this kind of an attitude that I would want to impose on others. I would hope that as Catholics we would be able to work towards building a society where abortion would not be the only alternative for people. And I think that, he makes the point that some 50% of the people having abortions are Catholics, so that the Catholic Church has not succeeded with its own people in offering them alternatives to abortion. And so that we have to, as Catholics, if we want to change the abortion picture in the United States, I think we have an obligation to try and improve society so that abortion won't be the only alternative.
And also to try and dialogue with the very large number of men and women of good faith who disagree with us. One of the big changes the Vatican Council was supposed to have introduced in the Catholic Church was to substitute dialogue for denunciation. And now it would appear that Archbishop O'Connor and Cardinal Kroll here have sort of turned back the clock, and we're no longer dialoguing. We're denouncing, we're demanding, we're ordering. We're not only excommunicating, as it were, non-Catholics, we're also denouncing men and women who are devout Catholics, who are in politics in great part because of religious devotion, and we refuse to permit them, these bishops refuse to permit them, the flexibility that they have to have if they're to apply their principles to the complexities of public life. I think that the abandoning of dialogue on this issue, particularly when there is a Catholic woman running for office, has been a terrible blow to the whole new religious understanding that emerged since the council. And, the crazy bishop here in Pennsylvania who referred to Mr. Bush and Geraldine. I mean, I thought that was only too typical of a way a lot of priests and bishops think, that here is this nice little lady who would make a good president of your altar society, but how dare she run for president of the United States and disagree with us while she's doing it? On the other hand, I think that the Cuomo speech at Notre Dame was marvelous because it was the prince, if you will, taking on the bishop, as happened many times in the past history of the church, and the prince beating the bishop in an argument, and the prince really being a more effective teacher than the bishop.
Do you think that the church or that any organized religion should be as active in politics as the church became in this past election?
I think one of the reactions a lot of people have had, there's been a lot of negative reaction among Catholics to the fact that their bishops are concentrating on issues such as this, even on issues such as Nicaragua, and not really addressing the critical issues in the personal and communal lives of their people. So I mean, I think the bishops have an obligation to proclaim their opposition to abortion, or their opposition to nuclear war, or their opposition to the various kinds of things, if they are really grounded in sound sound basis. But the real important issues in their faithful's lives, they're not addressing. They're not really addressing the whole problem of bad liturgy, which is crucial in the church today. But maybe it's easier to get up and denounce abortion than it is to try and come up with a positive proposal for liturgy.
It's cheap grace to denounce nuclear weapons and not denounce the oppression of women in the church. It's cheap grace to attack abortion and never speak a word about the problem of rape. 40% of the women in our country have been the targets of attempted rape. A third have actually been raped. When do you hear a sermon about rape? When has there been a bishop's statement on the subject? Even our own cardinal in Chicago takes a much broader view of life questions than do Archbishop O'Connor or Cardinal Kroll. I've never heard anything from him on rape or the sexual molestation of little kids or of incest of girls being abused by their fathers. If people are really interested in doing anything more than winning points with Rome, then I think they have to speak on all the life issues. And if you're concerned about the right to life, what about the rights of those who are supposed to bear life and who are so subject to endless fear in our society? Women have to live, and they've lived most of human history, they have to live in our society in endless fear of serial rapists, of molestation, of abuse, and not from the, you know, the occasional freak that lays in wait in the bushes, but often through members of their families. And if the hierarchy starts speaking out on that problem, then I'll believe it's something more than just a public relations gesture.
Women cannot become priests. Am I right in assuming that you'd both endorse the church allowing women to become priests?
Yesterday.
I say tomorrow, and she says yesterday.
What do you think are some of the reasons that won't happen now, that's not happening now? I mean, do you see it as being at all political in the traditional political sense, that people protect the power they have and don't want more competition to deal with?
Well, that's probably part of the issue. I think it's very much tied into what we mentioned before, this fear of women, mistrust of women. Somehow the fact that women could take Christ's place. I mean, the priest is supposed to image God, and I think that's a power thing. I'm going to be up there as a man imaging God, and to allow a woman to also image Jesus, that's one argument, is that you can't have a female image Jesus who was a male.
Logically, it would mean you can't ordain anybody but Galilean Jews, that kind of argument. Because Jesus was a Galilean Jew. How can you ordain a Cleveland Pole or a Chicago Irishman? I think there's also, you have to say, though, that the data show that men are more likely to support the ordination of women than women. And indeed, there's only one demographic group in the Catholic Church where you get overwhelming support for the ordination of women. That's Irish Catholic men over 45. Probably because at that stage in life, we've had so many sacred women, our wives, our mothers, our sisters, our daughters, that we figure may as well ordain them. It's not going to enhance their sacred power already. They're already so powerful. And besides, if we didn't support it, we'd be in lots of trouble. So this point, I think, needs to be made, that until you get in the 20s, it switches in the 20s. You get in the 20s, on most feminist issues, men are at least as likely to support the rights of women, and in some cases more likely than women are. The biggest enemies of women, it seems to me, are other women and priests.
Well, this leads us to the question of the hierarchy in the church, which is another subject that you bring up in your new book. You'd like to see influence and power centered more in the parish as opposed to in the upper part of the hierarchy, because he thinks that that's the most important communication that people have with their spiritual leaders is on a local level.
Oh, I think it is. I think the church is important to people at the local level. The hierarchy, you know, maybe you need them to run a worldwide church. But as far as who has the most influence on your life, I mean, the Pope makes statements on birth control. People aren't paying any attention to them. Possibly if the Pope made some more readily understood statements on the theology of sexuality, people would get something out of it. But they'll only get it out of it if they have a community supporting them in celebrating the positive aspects of their faith. So I think Andy mentioned earlier that if you had the imaginations of people until they were seven, that you could really help them to appreciate Catholicism. And so that means that the family is tremendously important. People learn about God from their family situation, not consciously. Oftentimes it's at a preconscious level. And the family is able to pass on positive visions of God if it has a community, support of other families working together. And so that's why coming together in church on Sunday and having good liturgy that helps you somehow understand the struggles and the joys of your week are struggles and joys that link you to God. So it's the local church that is, I think, the place where the Catholic Church will be saved.
I think that half the religious education that really matters happens at Christmas time. And at Christmas time, before we're 6 years old, our mother drags us over to church. You know, she drags the little girl over to church and shows her the crib. And the kid is fascinated because there's angels and there's saints and there's wise men and there's shepherds and there's little boys and girls and there's animals and there's a baby in the crib. And who is the baby? Well, the baby's Jesus. Well, who's Jesus? Well, mother isn't quite sure the theology, but she says Jesus is God. Oh, well, who's the lady that's holding Jesus? Well, that's Mary. Well, who's Mary? Well, mother takes a deep breath. Mary is God's mother. Oh, makes sense to the little kid. Everybody that's anybody has a mother. God is somebody, therefore God has a mother. And there's all kinds of images and pictures the child comes away with, which will stay with her for the rest of her life. And it will be someday a very small psychological step from thinking that God has a mommy to understanding that God loves us like a mommy. And it's that sort of richness of the Catholic tradition which is so overwhelmingly powerful, and the rules pale into insignificance. You know, there's always been, even in the old seminary that I attended when my sister was still a wee infant, the notion that the learning church is equally infallible to the teaching church, that the laity together are as much a receptacle of God's revelation as the Pope and the hierarchy. I think one of the grave weaknesses of our ecclesiastical leaders is they don't really believe that. They think they have a monopoly on the Holy Spirit. They don't really realize that the tradition has always believed that the Holy Spirit also speaks through the people. If the hierarchy, if the Cardinal Krolls and the Cardinal Bernardines and the Archbishop O'Connors and the Pope John Paul II, if they listened more to the experience of the laity, as the tradition says they should, then I think a lot of our problems would be solved and a lot of the crises with which we're faced wouldn't exist.
You've both mentioned the importance of good liturgy. So I'd like to hear what you think good liturgy is and examples that you've seen, participated in, held.
Short.
With good sermons.
With good sermons, yes, yes. The point that I make in the book, and I think it's crucial, is that if a homily on Sunday could contain one good idea that the people could leave church with, at the end of the year, people would have 52 good ideas, good images, good stories that they could remember. Now, for the most part, they have none.
One good idea in one good story, because the story is what will help you to remember the idea. Jesus was a storyteller. He told parables. If you want to find out what Jesus thought about God, go to the parables. And they weren't moralistic stories. There was no ethical content in them. They were rather stories about what God was like. And the crowds followed Jesus, I'm sure, because he was such a great storyteller. Liturgy has to come out of the experience of the people. The liturgist and the preacher has to understand the religious experience of his people, call that experience forth, and link it with the experience of the overarching tradition. All too often now, liturgy is somebody's had a semester and a half of advanced education. He comes into a parish with preconceived, a priori, historic historical ideas, which he imposes on the people, to see that the people have not the experiences they've had, but the experiences he thinks they should have. And that's just disaster.
That's why in the past, although I'm not advocating that we go back to the Latin liturgy, but I think what we did, as I look back on it when I was young, what we did is we went to church and we sort of didn't understand the Latin. So we did our own conversing with God. We said our novenas or our rosaries. And whatever was the crucial issue in our life at that particular time, we reflected on that. And so we had some kind of a communication with God, that a linking that we don't often have. We can go to a liturgy on Sunday and not have that kind of a linking. Some of the good liturgies I've been at have been recently have been connected with, my daughter's wedding. That I think was good. It had, because it was addressed to a particular experience, and the homilist is present with us, and so her uncle gave the homily, and I think it was very, very much directed to what was going on. There was good music, there was participation on the part of the people, and everyone left sort of feeling good and hopeful about the couple getting married, and also about themselves and about marriage and love. So I think you need good music. You need a liturgy that's not too long and not too dragged out because of the weekliness of the event. And you need good homilies. And you need relevance to people's lives.
Good music. You want to explain what good music is?
We'll have good music in the church when we're willing to pay church musicians a decent wage. Well, you know, for most of the history of the Western world, the church presided over the artistic tradition. Music, literature, sculpture, painting, architecture. The church was at the center of these things because it realized then that the artist was a sacrament seer. The artist was somebody who could see God in things more clearly than the rest of us and call images of God out of things. Well, somehow or the other, that's all gone. We've lost touch with our artistic heritage. We think art is perhaps a dangerous luxury because it makes people proud, or at best maybe a useful option. We don't realize that it's absolutely essential to the Catholic tradition, and that while a guitar mass occasionally may be a good thing, guitar mass and folk music is by no means the only way, and not even necessarily the best way, to worship God. We need good music. We need lots of good music, music that people can sing. We need beautiful churches, beautiful statues. We need, particularly in this day and age, we need novels that tell stories of God, screenplays that are comedies of grace. The church must once again, and it's not an option, it's absolutely essential, it must go back into the art business. And, you know, you tell this to priests and bishops, they look at you like you're crazy. I must say, you know, in writing my own novels, I am astonished at how effective they are as religion teachers. I set out to write novels because I believe that stories are the way you talk about God, but never in my wildest moments did I think that so many of the people that read them would understand what I was up to.
So I think what religion is all about is addressing the mystery experiences of our lives, and what the artist does is has his or her finger on that kind of place in your life that you're not even aware of what's going on, but they catch it and they present it to you in such a way that you say yes. And if they are religious artists, then they're saying there's a link between this experience and your belief in God.
Did you grow up in a religious family?
It's funny, we were just talking about that in the car on the way over here. Yes, we did, but we did not grow up in a pious family. We grew up in a family in which religion was important. I mean, my parents were religious people, but not pious. And so religion was never a heavy burden. It was something you did. My father, I can remember seeing him kneeling every morning at his bedside and saying his prayers, and yet he wasn't. I used to worry about him as a kid because he didn't go to communion on Sunday. I thought there was some grave thing wrong with him. So I think that's how I would categorize it, wouldn't you?
There was never a priest at our house for dinner until after I had graduated from the high school seminary. On the other hand, and this was virtually unthinkable in those days, my father was close enough to some priest to be on a first-name basis with him. So it was a kind of a paradoxical religious family, which may explain why these two offspring of it, at any rate, are such paradoxical people.
Let me just ask you briefly, because we're running out of time. What did you like most about the liturgy when you were young and you were first going to church?
Well, I think that there was a kind of mystery and awe. I can remember walking in church and just feeling like I was in a special place, and that there was something special about this. And the church on the corner is, and it was open, oh, goodness, it must have opened at 6 in the morning and been open till 10 o'clock at night, was a constant reminder that God was in our midst. And not just the church, but the school building and the gym and the playground and the convent and the rectory. And we were very fortunate, I think, in that we grew up in a parish where there was an openness. But I think that in the church building itself, there was a kind of mystery. God. And this is when I was real little, and it just kind of...
Yeah, sacred place.
And being in processions, being in May crownings. I mean, those were good experiences.
Another thing that was just wonderful for me was, particularly when I come home from the seminary on vacations, and go in the church, and there were my people, my friends, my neighbors, we were all together there. We came out of church and the priests were there talking to us. And somehow I felt that when I would come out of the church and see the parish priests, see all the people around, hey, this is it. This is the Catholicism I want to be a priest to work in.
Listen, I've really enjoyed speaking with both of you. I want to thank you a lot for being here this afternoon.
It's been nice to be here, Terry.
And I've been speaking with Father Andrew Greeley and with Mary Greeley Durkin, their brother and sister, and they've co-authored a book together. It's called How to Save the Catholic Church, in which they propose that there's a Catholic sensibility which is embodied in its liturgy and the symbolism in its storytelling, and that Catholics need to consider that and reconsider that in order to strengthen the Catholic Church. They also propose several church reforms in their book.